This is a public, or this is the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We're meeting on April 22nd, 1987 at 5 o'clock p.m. in hearing room 343. This will be a public hearing on Senate Bills 318, 490, 518, 564, 566, 756, and House Bill 2191.
Senator Frye is president of the subcommittee. One to take public testimony on Senate Bill 756. Clint Simpson. You're not Clint Simpson, a Simpson, are you?
I'm Clint Simpson.
You are?
Frye,
I haven't seen you since you grew that beard. I don't recognize you anymore. Been a number of years, yeah. Come on up. I'm calling this one first to make sure it gets heard so you don't have to make another trip to Salem.
I appreciate that.
Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my name is Clint Simpson. I'm an attorney practicing law in Eugene in a law firm. Our firm emphasizes personal injury work, and the measures that are in this bill pertain to amendment of, first of all, a statute dealing with uninsured motorist protection, and initially a statute dealing with how judgments may be reduced by personal injury protection benefits, which are paid by personal injury protection insurance carrier. The first section of the bill deals with that personal injury protection issue, commonly known as PIP coverage. The way that ORS 18.510 is currently worded, a court following a civil judgment in a personal injury claim is allowed to reduce that judgment by whatever personal injury protection benefits have been previously paid to the plaintiff. And this tends to work unfairness in certain cases because if a plaintiff recovers wage loss benefits and medical expenses from a jury which were previously paid to him or her, then certainly that judgment should be reduced because the liability carrier has to pay the PIP carrier back. But the way the statute is written, a plaintiff who does not recover medical expenses or wage loss benefits from a jury still must face reduction of his or her judgment by the PIP benefits. Even though the jury does not award them. So the purpose of this proposed amendment would be to limit the extent to which a civil judgment can be reduced by PIP benefits previously received. If the jury awards those amounts to the plaintiff, then the judgment can be reduced. If the plaintiff receives only general damages, then the judgment cannot be reduced.
Okay, now. I understand the second clause of that new language. The first clause, I'm having a little difficulty getting a hold of now. The insurer may submit only the proportionate share of such payments that were included in the original judgment. Give me a, for instance.
Well, the way the statute is currently written, it allows the defense attorney or defense carrier to reduce a judgment only by the proportionate share, and this gets into the finding of whether plaintiff was comparatively at fault, so that if a plaintiff was, say, 25% at fault, then the PIP benefits, the defense attorney is only entitled to 75% reduction of the PIP benefits made. So in the amendment, we've kept in that portion where you first have to compute a proportionate share of the plaintiff's responsibility, and then the second portion simply indicates what I've talked about, that in no event shall any award of general damages be subject to the reduction provisions.
All right, let's see if I understand this. Now, suppose the jury awards $100 in special damages for medical expenses and finds that the plaintiff was 25% at fault. So the plaintiff is going to get $75 special damages. And so what this says is that, and suppose they're $5,000 in general damages. Right now, the PIP carrier would be entitled to $100 out of the $5,100 verdict, right?
Well, with the 25% reduction, I would think the PIP carrier would be entitled to get repaid $75.
All right. Is that the way the law is now, or is that what you're trying to get it
to
be?
No, that's what the law is now. The situation which we're really after, which we see in jury trials, is where the jury, for example, awards $5,000 general damages, but only awards, say, $500 for medical bills, whereas the PIP carrier had previously paid $2,000 in medical bills.
Right.
Under the present statute, the defense carrier or defense attorney can apply to the court to reduce plaintiff's judgment by the full $2,000. This amendment would limit the reduction of plaintiff's judgment by the amount that the jury awarded for medical expenses, which in my example would be $500.
Well, that's certainly what the second clause does. I thought it was, but well, suppose a PIP carrier paid $100 for medical expenses and $100 for lost income, and the jury awarded $100 in special damages to cover lost income and didn't make any award at all for medical expenses. Now, under present law, the PIP carrier is entitled to get out of the judgment, $200?
Well, indirectly. Of course, the PIP carrier's reimbursement comes directly from the liability carrier. It's the liability carrier, or through the defense attorney, which applies to the court for reduction.
I mixed my figures up there. The carrier, the PIP carrier, pays out $500 in lost income and $100 in medical expenses. Now, the verdict comes back for $100 in special damages. And it comes back for $1,000 in general damages. Now, under present law, is the PIP carrier entitled to get $600 out of that $1,000?
Indirectly, yes. The PIP carrier is going to be entitled to get its $600 back from the liability carrier. The liability carrier can apply to the court to have plaintiff's total judgment of $1,100 reduced by $600. What we're attempting to do with this amendment in that example would be to limit the liability carrier so that they could only apply to the court to reduce plaintiff's judgment by the $100, which is a portion that the jury attributed for medicals.
Right. Well, I'm sure that's what you're trying to do. I'm just trying to figure out how that phrase, the first clause of that new language there, we're talking about 756, Senator Brockman, and we're looking at the new language on line 23.
Say the number again.
756.
Thank you.
The insurer may submit only the proportionate share. The insurer, now that's the plaintiff's carrier, right? The insurer, or is that the defendant's carrier?
That, I believe, is the plaintiff's carrier, the PIP carrier. I may be incorrect. Let me, if I take just a second.
Page 1, lines 23 to 26. I'm trying to figure out exactly what it does.
I believe that refers to the PIP carrier. So the underlying language, the insurer may submit only the proportionate share of such payments that were included in the original judgment.
Stop right there. Okay, well, that's not terribly clear to me. But...
All right.
I see what you're trying to accomplish, but I'm not too certain that this...
Well, we grafted the word insure from the language earlier in the paragraph. Starting at line 19, the amount of any benefits referred to in subsection 2 diminished in proportion to the amount of negligence attributable to the party in favor of whom the judgment was entered, and diminished to an amount no greater than the reimbursement payment made by the insurer under ORS 743.825. The reimbursement payment made by the insurer refers to the amount paid by the liability insurer to the insurance company that made the PIP payments to the plaintiff. So what we're saying then, and this would correct what I said earlier in the proposed language, the insurer, which would be the liability insurer through its defense counsel, may only submit the proportionate share of such payments that were included in the original judgment. So if, in fact, the plaintiff were found 25% at fault, the liability insurer can only ask for a reduction of 75% of the PIP. That portion, of course, is in the former statute.
Yeah.
Because if the liability carrier only has to pay back the PIP carrier 75%, then they should only be entitled to reduce the judgment by 75%.
All right, go ahead.
I can work on that line.
The Section 2 of the bill proposes to amend ORS 743.789, which is one of the preliminary statutory sections dealing with uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage. The present statute states that insurance carriers writing liability coverage will make an offer to uninsured to write uninsured motorist coverage at the same level as the liability limits. So if they write a policy with a $100,000 liability limit, they are supposed to offer the policyholder higher limits of uninsured as well. What we have proposed in the amendment is to change the language to remove the fact that they must offer the insurance. The proposed amendment requires that uninsured be written at the same level as the liability limits. The reason we are proposing this change or support this change is because the way the statutory scheme is set up, first of all, uninsured and underinsured coverage is the same thing. If you have uninsured at a certain level, you have the same amount of underinsured coverage. It is not uncommon in our practice and in our conversations with other attorneys representing people, it is not uncommon to see people who have taken the effort to have high liability limits of $100,000 or higher, but they only have $25,000 or the minimal requirement of uninsured or underinsured coverage. And in our experience, this difference in coverage that people have is either because they don't fully understand what the insurance company is offering them as required by the statute, or they don't understand what uninsured or underinsured means. And the proposed amendment simply takes the guesswork away from the insurance purchaser. If they purchase higher limits of liability insurance, then they automatically have the higher coverage. They will not run into situations where they think they are protecting themselves by buying high amounts of insurance and then find out when they're hit by a uninsured or minimally insured person that suddenly they don't have higher uninsured coverage when they could have had it. I may be naive on the point, but I fail to see how this would have any detrimental effect to the insurance industry, since they will charge a correspondingly higher premium for the uninsured benefit.
Okay.
And the final Section 3 of the bill is, I believe, the most or least controversial portion. Under the current uninsured motorist statute, which is fairly long, it has a provision for handling uninsured motorist hearings by arbitration. And we are seeing in our practice, and I have seen through questions addressed to me by various other attorneys in our area, we have seen a dramatic increase in the number of uninsured and underinsured claims in recent years. And uninsured motorist arbitration hearings are becoming increasingly common. The problem with the statute as currently drafted is that it says that arbitration hearings will take place under the arbitration laws of the state of Oregon, but it says no more, and that is a very vague kind of indication in the statute. Some insurance policies in the uninsured motorist provisions provide for each side to pick an arbitrator, and then those two pick a third arbitrator, and then there's no other indication as to how the hearings are to be held procedurally. Some insurance companies provide for arbitration under the rules of the American Arbitration Association, and the proposed amendment simply indicates that instead of arbitration hearings being taking place under the, quote, arbitration laws of the state of Oregon, end quote, it specifies that all arbitration hearings will be held under the provisions of the American Arbitration Association. That association is a longstanding nationwide organization with regional offices, one in Seattle, and they provide specific written procedures for presenting testimony, the use of medical reports and affidavits, and a specific procedure for selecting arbitrators. The purpose of this proposed amendment is simply to provide uniformity so that plaintiff's lawyers and defense lawyers alike have a procedure for handling these types of cases.
Okay. Any questions, Senator Brockman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Is the American Arbitration Association their nearest office to Oregon is in Seattle?
Excuse me, Senator?
Their nearest operation is in Seattle?
It is in Seattle.
Be submitting all this stuff by mail?
Yes. According to the American Arbitration Association procedures, which we have followed in cases where the insurance company policy provides for that, it requires sending in a written application to the American Arbitration Association with a filing fee, which I believe is $200. Then the association promptly sends out a list to the insurance company and to us of the names of five attorneys or arbitrators in the local area. They maintain lists of active participants, and then each side will strike off two, and the remaining arbitrator is the one who hears the case. In many cases, the arbitrators serve for free. They donate, volunteer their services, which actually has a beneficial impact on the insurance company because under the statute, the claimant is only responsible for the first $100. But it does provide a very specific procedure and a very efficient procedure for handling the cases.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you, Chairman.
Tom Bessonette.
I'm Tom Bessonette with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company, and I appear before the committee in opposition to Senate Bill 756. I was interested in listening to the testimony because I really was in doubts as to what was attempted to be accomplished and what was actually being accomplished by the amendments on page one. It seems to me that I'm still in doubts. Where the plaintiff alleges in their complaint special damages and general damages, and the jury returns a verdict for general damages only, there must be possibly some doubt in the jury's mind as to the validity of the special damages, the amount of them being fair and equitable, and therefore they just solve the issue by sending back a verdict for general damages sometimes. I can appreciate the fact that there may be some problems in this particular area of the law, and I've talked to several defense attorneys, and they wanted time to find out what was being attempted to be solved by these amendments. And I'll be happy to report to them tomorrow as to what is attempted being solved to see if we can resolve it with simpler language and go about and do the same thing. But where the jury has come back with the general damage and it has been alleged spatials to begin with, I really question whether or not we should then be tampering with the jury decision.
Well, it seems to me, Tom, that that's more a legitimate area to tamper in than if the... Because, you know, if the jury says it doesn't make any award of special damages, it seems like the insurance company that's standing in the wings there has got less of a claim on the general damages for its PIP, for the special damages that were incurred. It seems like you can make a better case than if the jury came back and said so much in special damages because of medical expenses or lost wages and kind of earmark a certain amount of that verdict, which I could see in fairness ought to be returned to the carrier, you know, that made the PIP payments.
That's why I'm not totally opposed to this section. I mean, I'm trying to find out and grapple with what they're trying to accomplish, and I really believe in equity, and I think that there is some inequity, but I don't believe that just by striking it out here. One of the things I would like to know is what case it was and who the defense attorney is so that I could talk to the defense attorney and see if there was some logical reason for the case that brought this issue forward that brought it about to start with. I mean, there, as you well know, there may be some very logical reason why the jury came back with just general damages. But anyway, okay. Excuse me.
I think counsel probably would like to hear from you on that because I think he indicates that this might be better worded, assuming that the theory is acceptable. It might be better worded, but you know there are some courts that just give the jury a verdict form, and the jury comes back with a one figure.
That's
never,
correct.
Never making the differentiation between special and general damages.
And maybe that's some of the areas that should be explored. I think the Culberstein case said that. You could use the PIP payments as spatials, and that has created some of the problem, I think, which is an appellate court decision. Maybe one of the logical discussions here is to allow the testimony of the treatment, but not necessarily those paid spatials that have been reimbursed already by PIP, and therefore not even being asked for in the evidences. Well, anyway, okay. Moving along. Mm-hmm. I have handed to you on page 2 of the amendments. I might say that any time you start meddling with the author of a bill, you usually find the author coming forth, and here I am. On the underinsurance, it was my idea, and I fought it out with Senator Ted Kulongoski when he was chairing the Committee on Consumer and Business Affairs, and we drafted language very carefully in order that we would not mandate people carry coverage if they did not want to carry coverage. I was so careful in the language that I even included the insurer shall offer, which has haunted us terribly since that day.
White versus Safeco?
Yes, absolutely. Which said that if the insurer, the company itself, did not make the offer to the insured, even if our agent did, that we, in fact, had limits equal to. And so that language has haunted me ever since then, and it has cost several companies many, many dollars. But in the handouts that I have given you, I have North Pacific Insurance Company's indications on, and they're a little bit tilted because this shows the number of policyholders they have on the left-hand side there, and they write only a single limit policy. So they... Under the $50,000 one, which is the first single limit, they do not have a single limit UM because it would not comply with the law. So they have to have a split limit. They have to have a 25-50. And as a result of that, a lot of their policyholders just have that one type. As you can see, 59% of their policyholders do not carry equal limits in both areas. They carry more liability trying to protect the other party and their own financial worth than they are willing to carry on them protecting their own selves, which I cannot understand, but nevertheless, the people have chose to do that. And I firmly believe that this is one of those areas where when we're talking about a cost in insurance, that we should still leave the people have the option as to whether or not they want to increase their own protection on first-party benefits. Then on the second page of the handout, there is companies A showing the premium differentials. They're not a whole heck of a lot. And it's ridiculous, personally, for anybody to carry less than whatever they want to protect somebody else for. But nevertheless, when you raise cost of mandated coverages, pretty soon people will fall out of the system. And when you fall out of the system, you'll end up having to pay more money under the uninsured motorist coverage claims, and they're going to have to raise the premiums. So I have no strong convictions on that. Fact is, it would simplify from the insurance company standpoint the whole process, but from the consumer standpoint, I question whether or not it's a wise decision. That's a policy decision.
Tom, can you tell me how I should read that second page? I'm not quite sure I understand.
Okay. On Company A, it's uninsured motors, UIM.
Right.
$25,000, $50,000 liability limits. The premium for the uninsured motors coverage is $7.25 for 6 months. Okay. That's a base premium, in other words. For 50 and 100, it's $10.30 for 6 months, or an increase of $3.10.
I got you.
That's the increase, the differential between the base coverage and from there on up.
Okay.
And then when you get down into Company B with their single limit, which is a bottom line, I was going to add Company C for single limits so that you would have some comparison. And as you can see, there's quite a differential even in the premiums on that coverage. With single limits like $500,000 on Company B for single limits is $21, and Company C it's $28 for 6 months coverages, a differential of $7 between the two companies. So there is quite a bit of competition out there for the premium dollar.
But, gee, it's always been just clear to me. And I've certainly seen some sad folks in my office who got smashed by an uninsured motorist and weren't willing to, hadn't been willing apparently earlier to cough up the $3. That's about what it would take to raise their limits. And these people are not dummies, but I'm sure that it's true that they probably don't really understand. They know they've got to have a certain amount of uninsured motorist coverage. That's mandated, but thinking in terms of their own liability. But I don't think the consumer is giving too much thought to the fact that the other guy very often is uninsured. And some of those cases are pretty sad. People think that they're well covered, but they don't, for some reason, understand that they may be covered if they're at fault, but they're not going to have the funds there to pay the doctor bills sometimes if they're not at fault. Well, I don't know how strongly people feel about that.
By the way, Oregon Mutual's policyholders, we've identified 55% of them carry the same limits both ways. So we are, more of our policyholders have seen the wisdom than has North Pacific's policyholders, I guess. They're 41%.
Okay, it's fair to say, Tom, that as far as the company is concerned, it's not going to be losing anything on the deal because you're going to charge the extra premium. You're saying that maybe you're a little concerned that maybe consumers won't want to pay the extra $3 or whatever it is, and some of them, therefore, will go uninsured.
Well, Senator Frey, what I'm concerned about, I guess, in the final analysis is you have been sitting through the liability crisis for 15 months. I sat with you on the other side listening. People complaining about the high cost of insurance. They were basically talking about commercial liability insurance at that time. You'll be hearing the same type of conversation when we mandate additional coverages on the automobile coverage, because they're going to be complaining not about availability, but affordability. And the insurance industry will be receiving the brunt of that conversation because of mandated coverages by the legislature. And so we see One, we realize that maybe we're wearing black hats today, and if we raise our insurance premiums because of mandated coverages, our hats are going to get blacker all the time because the public won't understand that it's mandated by the legislature.
Well, of course, I'll tell you, I don't know about Senator Brockman, but I get more contacts from constituents about trying to do something to really make insurance mandatory in Oregon, instead of just having a statute that says you have to have it. They keep asking me, can't you do something to ensure that these people are, you know, carry insurance? And, well, we know that we can't do that. But it seems to me that the same underlying philosophy that gives us our mandatory insurance coverage law in Oregon would also justify mandatory uninsurance coverage in a certain amount. It seems like the same reasoning is there because we're requiring, hopefully requiring people to have some source to take care of their loss other than having to depend upon the welfare and the public. I guess that's a very important consideration.
Getting back to one other point, will the insurance companies lose money to start with? Yes, because all we have to have is one loss at $500,000.
This the idea that the adverse party should have notice of what you're up to and for that matter why you think you ought to have it. So if we just put that into the rule, maybe that would take care of some of these abuses out here.
It would take care of most of the concerns that I bring to you today, Mr. Chairman, with the possible exception that in a very small number of cases, our learning of the possibility of prior injuries that could be part and parcel of what we're now being sued for comes about through our own investigation. It's like investigator interviews with family or coworkers or something like that. That kind of material is generally protected under a work product privilege, and if it's more important to protect the plaintiff's privacy from just random snooping than to protect our work product privilege, so be it. But there would be some loss to us in having to disclose in all cases how we came to believe that there was a concrete possibility of current claims that really relate to prior injuries. It often also arises by consulting with Safe Corporation or the Workers' Comp Department to find out about prior workers' comp claims. Depending upon the antiquity of the claim, sometimes very little data is available to us. The plaintiff's now claiming your classic whiplash-type injury, which is a cervical or upper back injury, and all that the Workers' Comp Department or the Safe Corp can tell us is that there was an 8-year-old back claim. They can't find much more in their records about whether it's upper back or lower back or side back or whatever. So we don't often have an awful lot to go on, but we think that it's reasonable to allow us to ask now, as long as we're at least in the same general part of the anatomy and we're not trying to make the quantum leap from back to psychiatric treatment that I referred to a second ago.
I certainly understand why prior injuries might have relevancy to the current claim. I fully appreciate that. I'm thinking of, you know, let me put this example to the committee members here. A person is, all right, let's take the cervical strain case. Rear-end collision, a soft tissue case, kind of routine. And 5 years before, maybe it's a female, maybe 5 years, well, it could be a male, but anyway, 5 years before the person was treated at a hospital for some terrible social disease, venereal disease, which, let's assume, would have absolutely no connection with the current claim for the soft tissue injury, but now there are the records sitting over there at the hospital, or maybe the person was treated for a psychiatric illness of some kind, and there the records are. I guess that's the policy consideration you have to weigh, whether you give up the right to privacy if you bring a claim against somebody. I suppose you do to some extent, and the question is how much of it. Well, anyway, that's what we're kind of talking about here.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, Mr. Chairman, I don't think we'd go after records if we knew it was that unrelated.
Of course you wouldn't.
And if we did, I don't think any plaintiff's attorney, except one that was asleep at the switch, would do anything other than go into court for a protective order. And I don't think any circuit judge would fail to grant a protective order on your hypothetical facts. So we have maybe a problem at the edges, but I don't think we have a core problem under current law and current practice as I know it.
I suppose, I'm sure you're right. That is, I don't think that most defense attorneys would go after the earlier record just because it might be embarrassing, nor do I think that most of them would try to get that into evidence in the trial. I guess it's just the idea that they know, all of a sudden, you know, other people know about this. Well, okay. Any other questions by committee members? All right, anybody from the OMA here? Okay. Anybody else on 564 here? All right, we'll close the public hearing on 564. And at least for now. And we will go to 318. And we will let's see now. I want to make sure, let's see if I got anybody from Malheur County here tonight. I want to make sure they get back over the mountains. Nobody from out of town here, so I'm not going to worry about that. I'll tell you what, though, for the benefit of those of you that want to go out and, to the powder room or something, after 318, we'll go to 566, and then we'll go to 490, and then we'll go home. Well, I was waiting to see if somebody was going to complain about the fact that I didn't mention that. 518. All right. No, we're gonna take that. I just wanted to see if you're awake back there. That'll be the last one. So here we go on 318, and I've got one witness, Brad Swank. At least one witness signed up.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, counsel.
There is also in your files a letter from Circuit Court Judge Stephen Harrell, who was one of the people who worked on this bill. His letter
right.
Essentially says that the folks in the Circuit Judges Association and the District Judges Association have not had time to look at some of the concepts in this, and they think maybe it's best left to another interim study. I think that if the committee was really interested in this topic, we could probably put something together before the session was over. But I'll wait for instructions from the committee.
Well,
but I thought while Brad was here, after all the work he'd done on it, he probably would like to say something to the committee about it.
Well, I would suppose so. Apparently, this thing had a heck of a lot of work in the interim, and I really don't understand judges that would say they haven't had a chance to look at it very well. Go ahead. What do you think about that? You want
My
to start
name
over
is,
again in the next interim on this? Or?
My name is Brad Swank, and I'm representing the Judicial Department. And I was the drafter of the bill while I was with the legislature during the interim. I would like to, the Judicial Department in general is in favor of the bill, thinks that the contempt laws need to be clarified, and the reviews that we've gotten on this particular bill from judges to whom we sent it out to review have been very favorable about the bill on the whole. There are a couple of specific things that I'd like to mention about the bill. I gave a very detailed memo explaining a section-by-section explanation to your counsel some time ago. One thing I would like to mention is that on page 2, lines 6 through 9, that concept of a person accepting money as part of remedial sanctions and then being foreclosed from a subsequent civil suit is optional. It was a drafting choice when the bill was made, and it could just as easily say that in the subsequent civil suit, any amount of damages awarded had to be considered. The next thing I'd like to mention to the committee is on page 3, lines 19 and 43, and on page 4, lines 5 and 6. These are provisions that reflect current law that talk about when failure to comply with a judgment or order for the payment of money is considered contempt. And under current law, that's limited to those circumstances mentioned in those three places that I mentioned to you. And it may be a time when the committee wants to consider whether or not it wants to expand current law to include other kinds of judgments or orders for the payment of money that can be considered contempt, because it doesn't include everything. On page 9, line 26, at the last word in the line is section, and that word is wrong. It should be subsection, and that was a drafting error that was made.
What line now is that?
Page
26.
Page 9?
9,
what?
Line 26. Last word in the line is wrong. If that word is section, then subsection 3 conflicts with subsection 4. And the last thing, and this is in the memo that I gave to your counsel, I might want to mention is that one of the problems that was not worked out with this bill during the interim was the problem of whether or not the maximum penalty should be mentioned in the citation for contempt, and then the court should be stuck with that maximum amount that they set. I am really not a proponent of the bill. It's the legislature's bill at this point, but I am authorized to say that the Judicial Department supports the idea of cleaning up the contempt statutes, and am authorized to answer any questions of the committee or provide further explanation if they would like.
Well, you know, I don't think any of us, speaking for myself, of course, I never was involved in any of the hearings leading up to this Senate bill here. I mean, I don't have any idea what the rationale was, how it came about, what people said.
Okay, I can explain that if you'd like.
I think that you should.
Okay. Last session, there was a bill that was introduced by Judge Harrell, and that bill would clean up the contempt statutes. The Oregon contempt statutes are something of a mess, and there are a lot of questions they don't answer. There are questions about what kind of penalties can be levied, who can bring the action, the amount of the penalties. And the Senate Judiciary Committee passed his bill out, and it got stuck in House Judiciary because of some concerns that the members of the House Judiciary Committee had at that time. I was instructed, during the interim, I was counsel to the Interim Judiciary Committee, and I was instructed to prepare this draft that would be a draft that would resolve those problems that the House Judiciary Committee had with the contempt statutes. And basically what the bill does is repeals existing contempt statutes. It enacts new contempt statutes that set out what the contempt procedure is. And contempt of court under Oregon law is used for a variety of reasons. It's not just for somebody misbehaving in court. If you fail to comply with the order of court or do something like that, you can be cited for contempt. There are a number of other statutes. Really, the substantive provisions of the bill are in the first 14 sections. The subsequent sections of this bill are all provisions of Oregon law that currently comply or that currently provide for contempt under varying circumstances and provide that different people can bring contempt actions. And what this bill does is conform all of those contempt procedures, all of the contempt procedures in the statutes, with the exception of those under the military law of the state of Oregon, to a single procedure. And it says that that procedure is something that is not a civil action and not a criminal action, but it's what in law is called sui generis, means of its own kind. And it follows current law. It explains the different kinds of penalties that can be imposed, and there are basically five different kinds of penalties that are sort of traditionally imposed under contempt. And it breaks it out, sets up procedures, and allows people other than the court and other than a district attorney to institute contempt actions, something that arguably they can do under current law, but it's not completely clear. But it sets out, it clarifies and sets out the procedure for them doing that. Contempt proceedings are brought in support enforcement cases and abuse prevention cases and certain other cases. Anyway, it's a clarification of the law and sets out, it expands the penalties and sets out the procedures, and that's basically what the bill does. I worked with Judge Harrell during the interim and also worked with some of the members of the House Judiciary Committee from last session who had some concerns, and tried to address them all in the bill, and basically created a vehicle that would allow you to deal with the problems in the contempt law.
Why do you use one spelling of subpoena, which I happen to think is the correct spelling of subpoena, and the rules of civil procedure use the archaic spelling?
Because the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, the spelling of subpoena in the statutes is a spelling that is established by a rule of the Legislative Council's office, and it was a rule that was adopted in the 50s during the grammar wars, and they picked up the spelling of subpoena that was on the Newsweek grammarless spelling, and it was a space-saving spelling. The Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure are prepared really not by Legislative Council's office, but they're prepared by I've forgotten whom exactly, but there's a
Council on Court Procedures.
Council on Court Procedures prepares them and submits them, and they stand unless the legislature changes them. So basically, they use their own spelling because those haven't gone through Legislative Council's office, and they apparently came down on the other side in the 50s grammar wars.
It seems a little bit incongruous to me that the Oregon revised statutes would use two separate spellings in one word.
Do you prefer this spelling in here? Is it without the O?
Mm-hmm. I think that's the modern spelling. I don't.
It was touted in the 50s as being the modern spelling because it had fewer letters and was more space-saving. There are some other words that in the ORS have similar problems. Employees spell with only one E, and you've probably noticed some of the others as you go through, but that's a result of the grammar wars in the 50s.
Any questions? All right, thank you. Anybody else here on 318? Okay. Did anybody on this committee work on that during the interim? Senator Hamby, I think, was. All right. Yeah. Senate Bill 566. We have just one witness signed up, Mark Comstock. Okay? No? 566, are you signed up? come up. Is there anyone else that was going to testify? Well, I wonder how come I don't have your names here. Because we have two witness sheets. Well, here's another one. Oh, Mr. Comstock got in late, so he signed on a separate sheet. So actually, he should be made to wait till the last, shouldn't he? But as long as he's up there, well, we'll hear from him. Go ahead. Identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Comstock. I am an attorney practicing in Salem here. I appear before you on behalf of the Oregon State Bar debtor-creditor section. We are mainly private attorneys who practice in the debtor and creditor areas of the law. Senate Bill 566 proposes to radically change the garnishment procedures in the state of Oregon. We acknowledge that there is an administrative problem with the issuance of garnishments, but haven't had sufficient opportunity to consider the implications of 566 and amendments that I received today. I can tell you right now that the executive board of the debtor-creditor section is badly split on this bill, and the main areas of our concern are the attorney issuance provisions, the trust fund provisions, that's in Section 4, and the judgment abstract provision in Section 19. I'd ask the committee's indulgence to allow the debtor-creditor section to submit testimony and comments in writing to the committee administrator within 15 days.
Well, I don't know about the 15 days.
As soon as possible.
Well, all right. I won't tell you what to do or what we're going to do, but if you want to do something, well, I would suggest promptness would probably aid your cause at this point in time.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman.
As counsel, did you have anything to say?
No.
Okay, anybody else? All right. All right. Now, Brad Swank, come on back up here.
Again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. You have a fairly large package that's being handed out to you. Let me explain to you what we've got in the package so you don't have to look through it all right now. First of all, you've got four things. First of all, there's a copy of my written testimony. Secondly, there is a copy of a memorandum that I gave to your counsel, Eric Carlson, doing a section-by-section explanation of the bill, the history of the bill, how we came to do it, what its purpose is. Third, we are proposing amendments, and the third document that you've got is how the law would look if the bill were amended as we've suggested and the bill passed. We've taken out all the underlining and bracketing, and it's just straight reading of the law. Fourth, you've got a set of our proposed amendments. And
who drafted this bill, by the way?
I did.
And this was at the request of the Judges Association, or?
It's a Judicial Department bill. It was submitted for drafting to Legislative Counsel's Office. They didn't have time. And so when I went to work there in December, it was one of the tasks that was assigned to me. It is not, it's a department bill, really, from the administrative offices of the department, not really requested by the judges specifically. It's for administrative purposes. Let me explain to you why the committee was very kind to introduce the bill for us earlier, and let me explain to you why we have a garnishment bill here, and it's a fairly big bill. During the interim between the 85 and 87 legislatures, State Court Administrator's Office was having two kinds of problems with the contempt statute. The first problem was that attorneys were unhappy with the processing of garnishment papers
and garnishment proceeds by some of the courts. It wasn't going fast enough. Courts are being something of a bottleneck because they processed the papers and attorneys didn't think we were doing it fast enough, or in some cases, they didn't like what we're doing. So that was one problem. The second problem was that some court clerks were spending a lot of time and therefore a lot of our money answering questions about garnishment procedures, including attempts of people to get legal advice out of court clerks. The State Court Administrator's Office put together an informal group that included people from the debtor-creditor section of the bar, that included court clerks from around the state and members of our legal staff, fiscal staff, and audit staff to speak about and try and work out some of the problems with the garnishment statutes. And of their suggestions, and they don't, not everybody on the group agreed with everything in the bill, but by and large, we got pretty much agreement from the people who were in the group about some things that are about most of what we went ahead and decided to put in the bill. And basically, the bill is intended to do four things. It's intended to clarify the garnishment statutes, and the reason for clarifying them is so that court clerks get fewer questions about what people are supposed to do, and so that it's easier for attorneys to follow the statutes, and so that some of the questions that constantly come up are answered. Secondly, is to establish a permissive procedure for Oregon attorneys to issue writs of garnishment on their own without having to go through the court clerks. Now, we've retained a court clerk issued writ under the bill, but we've set up a separate writ that can be issued by the attorney directly to the creditor, directly to the debtor, and sends a copy to the court clerk. It's a separate procedure. That way they can handle it on their own. Their officers of the courts are subject to bar discipline, and if they want to do that, they can speed up their own proceedings. Third, it allows direct payment to the creditor or to the creditor's attorney. This solves the problem for us anyway of having to funnel the money through the courts and having attorneys worry about how quickly we turn the money over, how long it's there, and those sorts of problems. And finally, it provides better instructions to the garnishee and the garnishment forms. We felt that if we straightened up the garnishment forms, provided good instructions, then when people got these forms telling them that they were garnishees and telling them what to do in fairly clear language, they wouldn't call the court clerk and say, what am I supposed to do? There are other reasons for these changes, and in the longer memo explains them, but those are basically the four things that we've done. In making the proposed changes to the law, we've tried to pertain, every effort was made to maintain the current protections in the law for the debtor. And we don't believe that we've changed the protection in terms of the debtor. We believe that under this bill, the debtor would have the same protections. After the bill was printed, we sent the bill out again for comment to the people who'd commented before, to judges, and to as many people as we could get to comment. Our amendments, our proposed amendments, are based on those comments that we received back. Some of the people, Mr. Comstock has commented, we've made amendments to address, we believe, many of the concerns that Mr. Comstock has. We've gotten comments from other attorneys, from people practicing in the area, and they don't change the basic purpose of the bill. What they do is change certain procedural aspects, clean up language that they had concerns about, make certain things clearer. One of the things we did was reduce the number of steps in the form of garnishment from 7 steps to 3 steps, so that would make it clearer for garnishees. Finally, you've got a copy of the memo that we gave to your counsel. We urge your favorable consideration of the bill, and we're willing to work with the committee or anybody else to try and get something done. The concepts in the bill, although it's a long bill and took a lot of changes, are basically simple. It sets up, like I said, a procedure where attorneys, if they want, can issue their own writs of garnishment. It allows for direct payment to the creditor, the creditor's attorney, provides better instructions, and it clarifies the garnishment statutes.
Why don't you tell the Chief Justice that if he is so concerned about the amount of time these clerks are putting in answering these questions, that he should get maybe about $10 worth of signs that would say, "We do not give legal advice," and make sure that every county clerk has one of those. Because I think a lot of this problem is the fact that county clerks are spending a lot of time giving advice on how to fill out forms and how to do this and that and the other thing. And that's one reason we're putting all these forms in the code, I guess, so that people don't have to ask lawyers anymore. They just read the code and then they go down and bother the clerk on how to fill it out.
Well, the garnishment forms have been in the statutes for a while, and it's because the legislature has wanted to make sure that the instructions are fairly standard in terms of what people do. We agree with you that clerks may be spending too much time doing that. Also, we don't really want the court to be the bottleneck between a creditor or an attorney being able to collect their money, because garnishments are a lot of paper to process.
Any questions, Mr. Swank, on this?
Also, I know that a lot of people, we just finished the amendments this morning, and a lot of people haven't had time to look at them fully, as probably your counsel hasn't had time to.
Now, as I understand it, the creditor-debtor section of the Oregon State Bar has not yet taken a position on this bill. Is that right, Mr. Comstock?
We are opposed to the original form of the bill.
But you haven't had a chance to go through the amendments?
Correct.
All right. I got it. Okay. Thank you. Then, all right, Ira Zeroff.
Ira Zeroff of Oregon Legal Services. I'm masquerading at the moment as Richard Slotty, who could not be here. There is testimony in your file, I believe, from Mr. Slotty, and I'd like to raise the issues that he raised. And I've asked Mr. Comstock to return with me because he can answer the technical questions. I am not an expert on garnishment and will not be able to answer them, I'm certain. Mr. Slotty, who is a professor at Northwestern School of Law, he's an expert in consumer law. He works at the Lewis and Clark Legal Clinic. He has a number of concerns about this bill, which I would just like to outline very briefly. He is concerned that it will be impossible for garnishees to verify the kinds of costs that are necessary, I guess, in a garnishment, that they will not be able to make certain that the right amount of money has been taken from them because of the costs in the bill.